the same day, they go out and they fly. They actually do circle eights and loop-de-loops around the front of their hive. Their GPS in the front doorway of their hive. So I can actually take bees that have done their orientation flight, crate them up, move them 2 miles down the road, release them, and most of those will make it back to kind of like a homing pigeon.
Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in a Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week, speaking with Ben Cooper. Now, to get to why Ben is on, I've got to tell you, about 2 years ago, I went to a bee farm. There was a Groupon for a tour and a tasting there. We went to the hives. We learned all about bees. We made a beeswax candle, all this kind of cool stuff. But what I gathered from it is bees are maybe the coolest, definitely the coolest insect, maybe the coolest animal out there. I mean, we're going to get all into it. Ben is a beekeeper. I didn't tell you that story then to tell you he's, you know, an actor or something like that. Ben is a beekeeper, somebody who's been doing it for decades. He's going to talk a little bit about his beekeeping. He's going to talk a lot about just the amazingness of bees. You may be thinking, what? Have you lost your mind? We're going to sit and talk about bees. We certainly are, because bees are really, really awesome. So many cool things. I don't even want to, you know, jump ahead here. But of course, we know that honey never goes bad. Bees have this very complex network of letting only their own into the hive. And we're going to spend, you know, the next 50 or so minutes talking all about bees. So like I said, let's not jump ahead there. But Ben's going to talk about bees, how amazing they are. He's going to talk about what got him into it, how he keeps them safe in the winters, all of the cool facts about them. He's going to talk about a book that he's written about the animals of the Bible. We're going to talk about just him as an author. We're going to talk about him as a mentor for up-and-coming beekeepers. So I do think you're going to enjoy this one. It's about a specific topic rather than necessarily just about the person's life. But that topic is bees. And, man, maybe you wouldn't have thought it before listening. But hopefully, by the end, you'll think bees are really, really awesome. Here is Ben Cooper. Cooper, how are you?
Living a dream.
Very good. I'm going to let you do the heavy lifting. Just introduce yourself.
All right. I'm Ben Cooper. Amongst many things, I'm a beekeeper. I teach beekeeping at a college close to me in Cumberland, Maryland. But I started beekeeping. People always ask what got me into it. I started at age 14 as a 4-H project. Mm-hmm. And I was the only 4-H kid in the county I grew up that had bees. So if you imagine, if I was a fish, I'd be a salmon swimming upstream when everybody else is going down. So I like to branch off and do things that other people don't do. It makes life more adventurous and challenging. So beekeeping just becomes part of that. And it's become more challenging over the last 20 years as well.
Yeah. And you said that you, before we started, you said you started at 14, but you've been doing it for what? Did you say 48 years, 49 years?
Yeah, 49 years been involved. It hasn't been a continuous 49 years, but from when I started was 49 years ago. During college, I tried to keep bees, but I was away, and that was tough. Back in the day when keeping bees was easy because we didn't have so many threats, but got back into it, and I love mentoring people. Oddly enough, I'd rather see more beekeepers and help them than sell more honey. It's not about selling and making. I enjoy being a mentor. And this coming Monday night, I will have about 9 people at my house where my bee yard is. The class is coming on a field trip. And it's hard to teach beekeeping without getting into a box of bees and experiencing going full tilt 100%. That's the way I like to roll.
No, I love that. And I wonder, you said that you did it, you started it at 14 as a 4-H project. So that means your parents at that point had to be a little bit on board. What did they think when you wanted to start keeping bees? Were they like, yes, absolutely, or were they hesitant? I mean, that's you were the only one doing it in, in your 4-H class. So obviously that's a unique thing. Were they supportive at first?
They were supportive, but they had nothing to do with it. The bees on the farm, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania, the beehive was far away from any house. So it was a bit of a travel, walking travel that I'd go. Wasn't old enough to drive. I could have driven, but I kept a box where my grandfather always kept a box. Why? Just because, he had one there, so I had one there. He wouldn't tell me much about it, and as an adult, I understood that he really didn't know much about it himself. But that was back in the days where you just could easily keep bees, and you didn't have a whole lot of threats to worry about. And so, even though I made a lot of mistakes, I just kind of overcame those and stuck with it because they're so fascinating critters to work with.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And when you filled out the form about being on this podcast, the reason why it really sparked my interest is I've wanted to have a beekeeper on for some time because I think it was last year, maybe 2 years ago. I think it was last year. I went to a bee farm and took a tour, and they taught us all about bees, and it's extremely fascinating. A couple of things that I learned that I had no idea about. This was I mean, it was a family farm, but it was, they have a store and they've got a lot of stuff going on. So it was crazy to me to think that they basically load their bees up every year on a semi truck and take them to Florida for the winter time. They get to vacation in Florida and then they come back. And he was talking about how, based on what flowers they are consuming, it changes the taste of the honey, which I had never even considered. I thought that was super cool. And then the coolest part of all of it was he took us to all of these houses, and of course he smoked it a little bit, but then he took out, one of the sheets. I don't know the words, but one of the sheets, and some of the bees came out and like landed on us. Not a single person in the 20 people got stung or anything. It was they He said, these bees are pretty docile. As long as you're not swatting at them or being, mean to them, the bees aren't mean, which I don't know. It shocked me. So I've got this thing in my hand with, probably 100 bees, and I feel like the average person would that seemed like a nightmare because they think they're about ready to get, killed. So I guess the question I want to ask you is, you've been doing it for 49 years. How often do you get stung? I assume you get stung sometimes, but not near as much as people would think.
It depends on the hive. Bees are such sensitive creatures. They are a indicator species. They can tell when something's wrong in the environment because they die basically if things are really bad. And colony collapse, even though there was lots of ideas of what was causing it, they still don't know. But especially if chemicals, pesticides, other things are being used in the proximity of where the bees are, some chemicals will pretty much kill the bees if the plant has been sprayed, and that's all it takes. But yeah, I've been stung. I think the worst case scenario, I was taking bees out of a chimney that had built a comb in a chimney. The chimney was decommissioned and taken down, and a roof built over top of it, and the house was being demolished. So I took a hammer and a cold chisel, and I'm beating their home away and taking them out. And I got stung probably 12, 15 times. That's probably the most I got stung. The most the bees stung my equipment with one hive was probably 230. I only got stung twice. That's with my full gear on. But since that time, that was a watershed moment for me, Jackson, because since then, and in my teaching, I said, listen to the bees. The bees will tell you whether they can be worked with or not. It could be simply the barometric pressure changing, and they are at stressed about an upcoming storm that we as humans don't even know. And so listen to the bees, let them, if I open up a lid and within 5 seconds there's 20 bees bouncing off the screen in front of my face, I know that it isn't a good day to work with the bees. And so those sheets, as you called them, but they're frames, as you pulled the frames out, you know, there's things that you can do. I don't always smoke them, but I had a guy here yesterday that is going to miss the field trip to my yard because he has a prior commitment. And so I said, well, come up whenever you can. He says, how about tomorrow? So I worked my bees with no gloves on, and he had gloves on. It wasn't his first time into beehives, but still a little timid. But I could tell usually within 5 seconds whether somebody would be a good beekeeper or not when we're in the yard. Because as you said, you don't swat them. You know, that's just going to draw attention to their aggressive mode, and just let them land on you. By the time I work my hives, I might have, there's times I get into the house and I'm carrying a few bees in with me because they're on my pants or somewhere on me. And once they're in the house, they go to the window, go to the light, just like most other moths and bugs. But it just listen to the bees. They will tell you whether they're acceptable. If their stress level is too high, they'll let you know that it isn't a good day to work.
Yeah, that makes sense for sure. And something else that I think I learned, tell me if I'm wrong about any of this stuff for sure, but he was talking, the person, you know, that took the tour with was talking about how his son had started a bee colony a little less successfully, but he had moved to Africa. So he was working with African bees. He said that'd be a totally different world. The ones we deal with actually are European, which I didn't realize. You know, I don't know whether honeybees are not native to North America, or we just work with European ones. But he said the African ones, way, way, way more aggressive, to the point where they're starting to mix with some European ones here in the United States. And that's becoming a little bit of a problem. Is that right?
Yeah. Africanized bees are a hybrid between two other subcultures. United States, get back to your other question, Jackson. They are not native to North America. There are no honeybee species in North America that are native. They are naturalized. That means they've been here long enough that our agriculture, the citrus grows in Florida. That's why they take bees in Florida. The almond groves in California strictly rely on only the honeybee to do the pollination. And the cranberry bogs and up north in New England, there's big blueberry patches that people will move those bees around. But they are considered naturalized. About 80% of pollination is done by honeybees. And so in agriculture, that's a big issue if 80% of the pollination is gone if our honeybees are under threat to all kinds of things, and all of a sudden they're gone. You might have seen it before that, you know, about one in every three bites of food that you take is thanks to a honeybee or a pollinator somewhere along the line. So if you like to eat, you need to have honeybees around.
I think I had heard that, which is crazy for sure. So I wonder, you know, you talked about how they're naturalized here. And this is kind of a basic kind of silly question, but is there a lot of wild honeybees, or is a lot of this from, you know, them traveling from farms, or is most honeybees really still wild?
Well, yeah, the rumor, and I think I haven't really traced it back, that the first colony came over on a Mayflower. Mm-hmm. So as long as pilgrims have been here, I did a podcast for somebody and they were anti-native anything. and the person had a distinct European accent. And I said, well, you don't sound quite native to the United States. And she kind of said, well, touche. Yeah, I guess I get your point. There's some people that advocate that we don't need honeybees. The honeybees are doing the work that our native pollinators will do. But there are actually 8 different species of bees in North America. Most of them are in the wasp category, but are already extinct. Honeybees are not. They're not endangered. They just aren't repopulating. So the honeybees that came over here that were managed got loose or swarmed away. That's a way that they reproduce. They create a swarm and go into a tree cavity or into somebody's house. Years and years and years and years of that, there's natural colonies or feral colonies that are out there that go into people's homes sometimes. And so beekeepers will go in and extract those. Or I get lots of calls. We're heavy wooded area. A timber company, lumber company cuts down a tree. It's hollow and there's bees in it. And so that's a lot more work because you have to split the log to get the bees out. So that takes big equipment, like not big equipment that's mechanical. It's a hammer and wedges. And you split that log and then you take the comb and the bees out. But they came probably originally from somebody's managed hive that didn't manage it well enough. They separated, swarmed, and went off and found a new home. They only can fly where they're about 3 miles from their wherever their home is. And so they start to spread and get further along. You know, I kind of think as the settlers moved west, they took honeybees with them. And now they're pretty much all across the United States, up into Canada. Elevation wise, when you start running out of trees, you run out of bees because there's no food source. Mm-hmm. I'll also hit on that experience that you went on a bee farm. I like to take my honey off in different sections or different timings because the bloom source of each individual plant determines the color and the flavor of the honey. If you go in a grocery store, you will find all the honey looks the same color. Honey has actually 12 different colors, from almost white that looks like water to black like coffee without anything added to it. And so in judging honey, there's different colors, 12 different official colors, and they break down based on the plant that they are getting that nectar from.
So how are you doing it to make sure that they're eating those other plants? This person, they took hives to basically other people's farms and manage them, like, oh, you have pumpkins right now that are blooming. You know, let's take a few hives over there and I'll manage them while they, you know, basically take your pumpkin flavoring from you. What do you do?
I let them forage. I have 3 different bee yards and I let them forage from there. I don't move them unless I'm splitting a hive from my home here and going to take that box to another one of my splitter yards or bee yards and move boxes from there here. I'm not traveling long distance. Everything's within 5 miles of my house. So what I do though is take the honey off after it's capped, right after that bloom source is done. So there's overlapping bloom sources all the time going on as long as we have rain and the warmer climate. And so up here in Pennsylvania where I am and in the Northeast, we've got 4 or 5 months out of the year where we're not getting any bloom source. And as soon as November hits or that first frost, killing frost in October, nothing happens. So what I do is honey having different colors and flavors. If I have 10 boxes here at my house of bees and I'm harvesting the honey that's capped off, chances are they're getting it all from the same source. I hold it up, the frame up to the light of the sun, and I look at it and say, this is light, this is medium, this is dark. And I will separate that and spin it out so that you can get different flavors. And basswood or the linden tree is probably from my locale is probably my favorite honey and it's a light yellowish honey that you can't get individually in a store, because bigger operations, they just homogenize. Everything gets thrown into the same. So everything from clear to black, it's somewhere in the middle of the road, and it's called amber, and that's what you see and you buy, and it's got a mixture. Nothing wrong with it. It's just you don't get to experience the difference between buckwheat honey, clover honey, the tupelo honey, citrus honey, you know, all the different flower source, bloom sources that the nectar provides for the bees.
Yeah, which I think is amazing. That's what I recommend people check out a bee farm for sure. Because yeah, trying all those different ones, and the only difference is that the bees were pollinating something different. So I thought that was really, really cool for sure. So, you know, what do you do with the bees in the wintertime? You said they don't have, you know, a bloom source. What are they up to in the winter for you?
Up here in the north, I try to manage and make sure that they've got roughly about 100 pounds of honey stored up. If it's a 10 frame hive, they're going to need about 100 pounds of honey, 80 to 100 pounds. And where I am, the winters could be harsh. They could be warm. It's actually worse the warmer the weather is, because the bees don't fly hardly at all under 40 degrees temperature. But if it's above 40 degrees, they're flying, and they're flying 3 miles to find food, and there's nothing out there because nothing's in bloom. The life of a bee is only, this time of year, is about 6 weeks. And they're called workers because they work themselves to death. And they log so many air, they can only fly so much. So the more they're flying, the quicker their lifespan. Over winter, a bee might hatch out the end of October and live all the way till March because it's not flying. Mm-hmm. And so I got to make sure, as a manager, as a beekeeper, to make sure that my hives have adequate food source in them, because they don't hibernate. They actually move and digest honey, and they actually use that. What it would look like to us is they get a stomach full of honey and get to the center of a cluster, and they shiver. Shivering burns calories, which generates heat, and they like to keep the queen likes to be about 92, 93 degrees. So it could be 20 degrees outside, but where the queen is 92 degrees. And it's a constant circulation of movement of bees all winter long, making sure that they have honey. If they don't, then I provide a block of sugar cane, basically, that they can go in and feed on. If they move up the box to the top and they run out of food, hit the ceiling, so to speak, then I need to make sure that I provide them with food, because they ate through too many warm days, they ate through their food. Too many cold days, they'll stall out and eat all the food around where they are. So it's a management. You got to manage them in the warm season and in the cold season to keep them alive.
And I think that's kind of an obvious thing, but I don't think people think about it too much, that the honey is, that's their food. That's what they're eating. So I don't think people can think about it. They think, oh no, honey is just, that's made for us. And they're supposed to be their food. So that makes sense for sure. And when you're talking about them being worker bees, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but you talked about how they work themselves to death. I think I've heard somewhere where, you know, if you find basically a worker bee who's worked themselves to death back at the hive, literally, if you like put them under a microscope, sometimes their wings are literally tattered up because they've almost completely wiped their wings out because they've flown so much.
Right. And some of them don't make it back to the hive. They go out for another forage run and they don't make it back, and they die. And but those are the older bees. They have kind of a caste system, where once they're born, they're stuck in the brood comb, and they're producing wax, the young ones. Then after a week old, all those that were hatched out a week prior, the same day, they go out and they fly. They actually do circle eights and loop-de-loops around the front of their hive. They're GPS in the front of their door, the front doorway of their hive. So I can actually, I don't know if you've heard this before, Jackson, but I can actually take bees that have done their orientation flight, crate them up, move them 2 miles down the road, release them, and most of those will make it back to kind of like a homing pigeon. But wow. if I did that 5 miles away, they'd run out of food and they wouldn't make it back. So 2 miles is pretty cool. They've tested them, putting paint on them, and knowing that these bees that were taken off, you know, they're mathletes, they're great communicator. They communicate way better than humans, faster than you could send a text to me. The queen can send a pheromone of aggression out. And this is where the Africanized bees do it even quicker, that all of a sudden that pheromone, that smell, that perfume that goes out throughout the whole hive, the bees come out and say they're in attack mode. They're going to put their stingers in whatever they're seeing out there. And that's what the Africanized bees do. That they come up here in packages from the south, but they don't like the cold winters. And so a lot of times they'll just leave their boxes and go off thinking we're going to head to warmer climate, and there isn't any, and they land somewhere and end up dying. So as Pennsylvanians, if we have suspect Africanized bloodlines, we have to kill the queen and get an Italian queen or something from, you know, the standard European breeds, and replace that queen so that after 21 days or so, then the new bees are less aggressive and you lose that trait of the Africanized bloodlines.
And you said that the, you know, the queen can release a pheromone that basically says danger. Is that what bees can sense? That is that the ones that are in the box, or is it the ones foraging 2 miles away? Are they able to smell that pheromone? Okay.
Only the ones in the box. And it's all the workers, all the workers, except for the young ones that haven't taken their orientation flight. If they go fly somewhere, they don't know the way back home. And one of the interesting things that a bee that doesn't know its way back home, if it goes into another hive, the guards will say, you're not from our colony because you don't have our queen scent, our queen's pheromone on you. But that lost bee actually can do sign language. Bees can speak five different ways, different languages, and they know sign language. That bee can do sign language. It sticks out its tongue. Its front legs pull at that tongue. And that sign language saying, I'm lost. Would you accept me into your colony? And so the guards then have the decision. Those guards that are there, they have the decision to either kill that bee or let that bee come in. If they let it in, sometimes that's how diseases go from one hive to the next. The drones, they don't have stingers, so the male bees don't sting. They're allowed to drift between different hives, and they can create problems with bringing disease from one hive to another hive, and or parasites, the mites that are a problem.
Yeah. And I wanted to touch on that. So most bees that are being productive are the female bees, correct? Let's talk about the male and female bees in these hives and what they're doing.
So you have the queen. She's actually not in charge, but her job is to lay eggs. Up here in the north, I'm happy if my queen's laid 1,200 eggs a day, and that's keeping the population. If I've got 50, 60,000 bees in a hive, that's a good, strong hive. And she's doing her job. When she drops below that, if the workers think there's something wrong with her, they will actually kill her and make a new queen. They have the ability to, any female can be a queen. As the only difference is a queen is fed a full diet of royal jelly, where workers get royal jelly for 3 days when they're an egg. And then once they pupate into a larva, then they get bee bread, which is protein, pollen, and carbohydrates, honey mixed together. And that's what they develop off of. But I like to think of it as about 30 years ago, veterinarians used to say, I love big dogs. I have a golden retriever. The bigger dog, the better, the way I look at it. But they used to say all large breed dogs had hip problems. St. Bernards, Newfoundlands, big dogs, that it was just, they would tend to have hip dysplasia problems. The problem was the nutrition wasn't given to them when they were young. And so their hip and their femur grew at different rates, and they needed a higher protein level in their food. So Purina came out about 30 years ago with puppy chow for large breed dogs. That fixed the problem of nutrition. So nutrition has a lot to play, whether a female egg can be a queen or not. And sometimes they'll make several of them because they just feed them. So they can kill their queen and remake another one. So a lot of people think the queen's in charge, but it's the workers that actually are in charge. And then they go out and get water, pollen. They protect the hive. They get nectar. They keep the queen warm in the wintertime. The males, they're geared primarily for mating with a queen. And you don't need a whole lot of drones in a hive with a good queen. If they kill that queen because something happens to her or she drops in production, then they need drones again so that queen can go out, a newly hatched queen can go out and mate. And then after about 3 weeks when it's hatched, that queen is fully mated, her cervix closes, and she's good for up here in the north. They can last 3 years. Down south in Florida, where those people take their bees, a queen can last 5 years because of the climate.
Yeah, that's interesting for sure. And I, you know, we've sprinkled in all kinds of really cool things about bees. I wonder, the question is, what are other cool things about bees? Have we covered a lot of it? I want to make sure that we haven't missed anything, because I know it's some, I told you the things I know, you've sprinkled in things. What's other cool things about bees?
Well, I'll just go through real quickly. I told you about bees know sign language. They know math. They designed the inside of their comb with 3/8 of an inch space. That's called bee space. So if you give them an empty box, they'll build comb in odd different patterns. But from one comb to the next will be 3/8 of an inch for the bees to pass through. We have frames. If you put the wooden frames in that wooden box, there's 3/8 of an inch gap between each frame. If you space them the right way, if you make them wider, let's say you put 9 frames in a 10 frame box, that comb's going to get drawn out more. It's going to be what I call fat frames. If that's your honey frames, it's hard to pull that out without ripping the capping off of the comb. You have to pull them off to the side one by one. You might destroy one frame and the rest of them are fine. But so they know math. If one science professor from, I think, Wisconsin took bees and fed them sugar water at 12 o'clock at a location for a week. The second week he took and fed them 300 yards away at 1 o'clock for a week. The third week he moved them 300 yards away and fed them at 2 o'clock. And then the next week, 300 yards away and fed them at 3 o'clock, and then didn't feed them at all, but set up cameras, and they were 300 yards away at 4 o'clock looking for the food. They were trained and learned and knew distance and knew where to go. The dance that pretty famous, the waggle dance that the bees do, it's a figure eight. Oddly enough, that scout goes out and finds a good source of nectar. Let's just say an apple trees are in bloom, and that scout will come back and it will orient its flight directed to the location of where the sun is on the horizon. And if it's high noon, it will be straight up. If it's 3 o'clock, it'll start its dance over at 3 o'clock. That's information that scout brings, gives the location, the distance, shares the flavor of the nectar, and they know the color of the bloom, all in the dance and then sharing the taste of the nectar, so that those scouts give the information to the worker bees. The worker bees go out to the exact bloom source that they're looking for. That's called floral constancy. I challenge you and anybody that listens to the podcast, watch a honeybee and they will not go to different flowers. If they're going to a garden that has pumpkins, vine crops have a male flower and a female flower, and bees are essential to pollinate them. But you won't see them go from a pumpkin or a vine crop to a dandelion. They work that bloom source until it's exhausted that day. They go back and find new marching orders from another scout and say, let's go over here and hit dandelion patch, or it's fall time goldenrod that's popular this time of year. So they stick to their guns when they go out and fly. That's why they are so much better pollinators, because apple trees to apple trees, only apple trees are getting pollinated, and they jump from tree to tree to tree, or vine crop to vine crop to vine crop. And that's what gives them that boost of being great pollinators, better than some of our natives that don't really care. They'll skip over and do that. The workers have hair on them, and that pollen gets all over them. And so while they're packing it on their back legs to bring it back to the hive, they are pollinating the other plants that they go to as well. And so it's a symbiotic relationship. The bees, of course, buzz. They communicate by sound, by dance, by sign language, queen piping. If give you a chance to look up, do a YouTube search on queen piping, and you'll hear, I can hear a queen piping in a box that has 50,000 bees in it. Her sound is uniquely different, and it sounds like Morse code in different pitches. That's what a new young queen hatches. And the bees are worried, well, our queen's dead, and she's announcing her arrival, but she's not fully mated yet, and her pheromones aren't developed to make them strong. As she announces, almost like I said, Morse code, in buzzing, shorts and long buzzes, that your hive has a new queen I'm developing, and basically makes a royal announcement, announcing her birth. And of course, the first one that comes out, if there's three queen cells, the first one comes out. If two of them come out at the same time, it's a fight to the dominant one. If there's enough time, that first queen will go and chew into the side of the queen cells and sting them before they hatch, so she can be the dominant one. She doesn't have to fight to the death. She just goes in and she'll use her stinger. So a lot of different things that bees do that, you know, like I said, they communicate five ways. I think from a human standpoint, and I watch humans and how they interact, and we all do in different ways, but, you know, dysfunctional humans don't even communicate one way very well. Honeybees do it five different ways, and they rely on it because it's one of the few species that gives everything they have. Their whole existence is for the next generation. They're not selfish. It's all for the next generation that carries forward young bees into the new year.
Now that's all really, really amazing. And based on something we were talking about earlier that I forgot to ask, and you just mentioned, you know, other pollinators. So you talked about this person who didn't like non-native things. So my question to that is, you know, there are non-native species of a lot of different things, plants and animals and things that are kind of strangling out the native species. Are bees a threat to the native pollinators?
They compete with the same nectar and pollen sources, but bumblebees will bring pollen back, but that you can't get into a bumblebee nest and find honey. Blue orchard mason bees are good pollinators. They're solitary bees. They live in a community, but they do their work by themselves. And a queen hatches or lays an egg, seals it off, and then they're great. They're good for pollination, but that's all they're going to be good for from our standpoint. You're not going to get any benefit unless your Bear Grylls out in survival mode and you want to eat the grubs to get some protein for yourself, because there's no honey and they don't store pollen as well. So, you know, oddly enough, most of the beehive are the products of the hive. The bees, the larva, the honey, the pollen, and the royal jelly, and the propolis, the sticky material, is all edible and beneficial to humans. And so honey does not spoil if it's capped. If it's capped off, it'll last for thousands of years. It might crystallize, but all you have to do is heat it up and it becomes liquid honey again. And it's a great food source. If that's all that you had, you've got moisture in it. You've got some benefits, antioxidants in it, and you're able to survive. It's one of the few foods that you can survive just solely on honey longer than most any other food source.
Well, that's amazing. I think if anyone knows any facts about this whole world, it is that honey doesn't expire. And I think that's really, really awesome for sure. And you just mentioned it. Let's kind of go into kind of everything to do with the hive, because again, this one experience I have, they sold caplets of, I think you said some of that, I don't remember. It was like white powder that, what do you say, populous royal jelly? And then I think they sold both. So talk about the benefits of that, because, you know, they had listed all these health benefits. So I don't know if you prescribed all that, but talk about it.
Some of the honey, even there's Manuka honey in Australia and New Zealand area, I think, grows both, or they can grow it there based on the plant, that it is a higher, healthier honey source than what we can produce here. But there's a new pest that's around our area called Japanese spotted lanternfly. It's a problem, and it eats trees and it defecates on trees. Honeybees will actually go and consume. Well, they don't consume it for themselves. They will actually take that excrement from the lanternfly and process it and make, they don't call it honey, they call it honeydew. So this is excrement from another insect. They bring it back to the hive and it's legally allowed to be sold as honey. It'd be best to label it as honeydew, but there's a benefit from that, because some of the new research coming out of, I think, Penn State and a lab in Texas, University in Texas, are both working together on it. And they're finding that that honey from the lanternfly excrement has even more benefits for health reasons. I don't use Neosporin. I don't buy Neosporin because I have honey. Honey is a sweet acid, and bacteria does not grow in acid. So if I get a cut, a scrape or something like that, I'm going to put honey on it, put a Band-Aid on it. It's liquid and it's natural, and it has antioxidants in it. It has the right stuff to cause healing to happen faster, less scarring. And even burn victims will use honey as a treatment rather than some other stuff. So there's so much that you can use from the bee source. The wax, the famous Michelangelo painting of the 16th, the Chapel of the Last Supper, only allowed to burn beeswax candles in that structure because it's pure and it doesn't have black soot that grows or comes off of the fire like in other candles that would give off, which would then destroy the artwork that's in the painting. So a lot of things are done with health, with candles, with salves, and of course, cooking and baking. One of the things that I have is a coin somebody gave me, was it's about 2,400 years old. And it has a bee on it, and it's one of the first coins ever having a bee image on it, because prior to that, they would use honeycomb as currency. They would barter with honeycomb and use it because it had such great value. Honeybees still are the most studied creature on the planet because people have been domesticating them and using them in hives and gaining the benefit of propolis, that sticky plant material that comes from, just think pine sap, but it's more than that. It's vascular plants that have liquid in them. They bring it back and they will coat the inside of a tree cavity with this propolis that creates a barrier so ants and other insects can't come in and steal their hard work, their honey. Beekeepers use almost glass-like plain pine boxes that bees can't put propolis on the sides of it. So we strip away one of their benefits or one of their protections, and we don't use it. But do you pollen? It's good. If you know that you're allergic to, let's say you're allergic to something like a ragweed, and a lot of people are, if you collect the pollen when ragweed is in season and then use it, it's better than getting a shot for the allergy of ragweed, because you put it under your tongue and let it dissolve sublingually. You're getting the benefit of what a shot would do without white blood cells coming to a wound that you poke in with a shot in your arm. You're letting nature use what it does without trying to defeat it. And it has a better long-term effect. So a lot of times doctors say, if you know your allergies, get honey or pollen from that source, and it'll help you get over allergies. And so some people do that. So the royal jelly, it's just a superfood that a lot of people, especially in the Orient, China and Japan, push a lot of different foods in that vein. And so they collected. I had a guy from India contact me and want to have venom, and me to produce venom for him by killing my bees, actually forcing them to be stung into a substance that will then store the venom. And then they use that for medicinal purposes for people. Some people do bee sting therapy for arthritis. And I know a guy that does it, has been doing it for Lyme disease, and help him with bee sting therapy. So all the products that are available, and of course, honeycomb is edible as well. That's how my grandparents used to eat it. They just slice honeycomb, gather it in a comb, wouldn't melt it down or extract it and spin it out. They would just eat it with comb and honey, and there's nothing wrong with it. Hmm. So the products there are just limitless. We're only scratching the surface of what some of the benefits are. That's why I tell people when I teach, the more I learn and understand honeybees, the more I realize I need to learn more. It's a continuous process, because we're always like three steps behind.
So, I mean, I think that's eye-opening to people to hear. It's so many different things. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned at the end, but the bee sting therapy. I had a teacher actually whose husband was wheelchair bound because he had MS, multiple sclerosis, and he had little boxes of bees sent to him, and that bee sting therapy was productive in helping with things. So yeah, I think it's wild, really, and I don't think a lot of people have any idea about all this. So I think that's really, really awesome. I my question to you is, you have all these different BERs. You talked about, these different hives, and what I think you said, like 20,000, 60,000, something like that. Bees are in these things. What are you somebody who, packages and sells these products? Is it just a hobby, or what are you doing with all of your products?
Well, last year, just with a small number of bees, I like to keep about 12 hives. Right now, I've got more than that. If I teach and somebody that takes my class wants bees, they're going to get my excess at a ridiculously low price, because they put the effort forth and they took a class and they learned the basics. I teach a 15-hour, one-credit course for beginners. And if they go through that class, then they've got the basics down. They forget a lot of things, just like I forget a lot of things too. If you're not written down or you don't remember it, now that, oh, I can't do that because I can't treat with this product, because it only is good if the temperature is below 80 degrees or whatever, So you got to keep a good set of records, know what's going on in your hives. But I don't really sell. I sell honey. but I rather say that I mentor and I make new beekeepers. That's my industry. Last year, I sold $2,500 worth of honey, beeswax and honey. And so it's nice to have a hobby that's good for the environment. It also pays for itself. I have not bought bees in over 5-6 years. I raise my own, make my own splits, catch my own swarms. And if I catch a swarm from someplace else, I'll usually give that to somebody else because you don't know what you're getting. You could be getting diseases. So I protect my hives from putting other bees into them. Some guy is moving away to Nevada, and he called me up. He took my class 2 years ago, has bees, and he said, "Do you want my 4 hives? I said, "Yes." Now, he said, "I haven't treated them for anything." So immediately I had to start looking at them a little quicker than I normally would in my regular routine. But teaching how to manage them throughout the whole year cycle for survivability is what I really like to do. And from March till probably October, I get emails, phone calls, Facebook messages. "Hey, this is going on in my hive. Here's a picture. Can you tell me what's going on? Can I?" And so that's my world that my ideal world is make the beekeepers that I am contacted with better as a result of the mistakes that I made for the past 49 years, if that makes sense.
Gotcha. Yeah. I think we could talk about this all day. So I've got two last questions. I'm going to put them together. Two last questions about bees, and then we're going to talk about your books and how people can reach you. So I'm going to put them together. That way I can't ask you any more questions after that. So the two are you talked about catching swarms. I assume, you know, that's wild bees. What's that process look like? How are you catching them, and how are you making them, I guess, go to your hive and do what they need to do? And then kind of this in the same vein, you said about splitting hives. How are you able to split it? And once that happens, do they just naturally say, "Oh, this is a new hive. We don't have a queen," and they create one there? Or what's that look like when you split?
Well, in the springtime up here where I am, it gets pretty busy in April because the way bees reproduce isn't the queen laying an egg, it's the colony splits. So the best and easiest swarm to catch is one that doesn't leave the hive yet. If it's 40 feet up in a tree, I'm not going to be able to get that. But I actually have some bait hives that I put some swarm lure in it with some queen pheromone, and called Swarm Commander. Spray in that every couple of weeks, and they will go to a box because it smells like there's been a queen there. If I can't, and I have to, it's definitely related to temperature. The bees might swarm on me before I'm able to get in. If they swarm before it's higher than 60 degrees, I need to, I can't pull out frames and kill all the uncapped larvae because it's too cold, they'll chill. I don't get into them and do full inspections until it's above 60 degrees. And sometimes they swarm. So if it's above 60 degrees, I'll go in and get the queen and maybe two or three other frames, move them into a smaller 5-frame box, and move them to my one of my other yards and make splits. I take them beyond the 3 miles that they can fly, so they're not coming back home. And the old queen goes with them. And if they haven't already started queen cells, usually I like to wait till I see queen cells because they're going to do it naturally. If you crowd them in a box, they'll do it quicker. They'll say, "We're running out of room," just like the tree cavity only can hold so many bees. And so they'll swarm out and split on their own. And I catch them. And you ask, how do I catch them? If they're within reach, even 12-foot ladder, I have a telescoping ladder that I can take with me. But if mine, they either go in or near the swarm lure box, the bait box that I have set out. I have an apple tree that catches probably 5 to 10 swarms every year because that's where my bait hive is. and they go into the bait, either smell that bait hive, and they usually go on a branch. And if a swarm goes on that branch, then another swarm 3 days later will go on that same branch, keep going back because of the smell, the pheromones there. And I've actually taken swarm commander pheromone, sprayed it on a branch when I knew I wasn't going to be home most of that day, and knew that it was a warm day coming up and it's been raining and cold. Bees are going to potentially swarm, and I can actually inoculate a tree branch within reach so that when I come home, yep, there's a swarm there. I will catch it. I usually lay a sheet down, put a box on that sheet, and drop the swarm right in front of it. And I knock like somebody's knocking at the door. And that hollow vibration, the bees are looking for a hollow home. The bees will march right into that box. I don't have to, if I shake them into the box, they'll try to crawl out. It's making them think they're doing it on their own idea. And they go in and they're more likely to stay, especially if I can catch the queen, put her in a cage or a clip real quick, they'll go in and stay. If the queen goes in, done deal. Then move them to the yard. Once they swarm, I can move them right next to the same hive they moved out of because they've left that home. That's past. That's history. We're starting new, and I'm giving them frames and boxes to start another hive in. And so that's how I make new boxes, new queens, let the source hive make new queens in. And usually if somebody needs hives, they get my old queen. Not that she's out of, I try to requeen every year. So the longest I will have a queen is 2 years because her production is going down. I want young, fresh, viable queens that have vitality, and they're producing a lot of eggs and keeping the numbers of bees up.
Interesting stuff. I find it really, really fascinating. I want you to tell us about your books. I don't know if they have anything to do with this, but I know you write books.
I write books, and I'll tell you, at least to link in with, I write about animals, and I write more of devotional animals. I'll tell you this, that me working so much with bees, I firmly believe, and it confirms to me, that things just didn't happen. Bees are so intelligent. And again, like I said, they're an indicator species, that there's some kind of intelligent design under all of it. So I write devotionals from a Christian standpoint and use animals as the connection point. And so my first book deals with All Nature Sings, but then I wrote a children's book from that, and it's for 4 to 8 years old. It's called Created Critters with Wings, and there's bees in it. My illustrator happened to take my class, but she's third generation beekeeper. And I said, can you draw a hidden bee in every page of your illustration? And she does it graphically. And she did. So kind of in that Where's Waldo world, I've got a storyline, a rhyming storyline about this specific bird or insect that has wings. And the kids that aren't old enough to read, they're looking for the hidden bee in the picture. And they can find it quicker than the adults. Because their eyes are sharper and they're looking at it, but it's fun. And I've enjoyed that. And I write for another publication, Guidepost Publication does All God's Creatures. And so I write devotionals for them as well and enjoy it. And every day, if I can go help somebody get bees out of their house or out of a tree branch, because it's in their yard, or help them become a beekeeper, whether it's through learning about them in a classic college class or through my writing, we can learn a lot from our environment and the critters around us.
I love it. I this has been a really fascinating conversation to me. Tell people how they can, I guess, pick up your books, any connection points you have, anything you want to shout out.
If anybody's interested in beekeeping, I manage a Facebook group called Buzzing Around the Tri-State. And that tri-state is West Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania near the Cumberland area. But I have people that are members of that from all over the world. There's people from beekeepers from Kenya and from Qatar, from Australia, from the Caribbean islands. There's so much interest in it, and it just keeps building. And then any localized things or things that are coming new to the beekeeping industry, try to keep that populated on there. So buzzing around the tri-state, Facebook, just send a message that you want to join and I'll add you. Other than that, the easiest way to get a hold of me is through my email, and that is Cooperville, Cooperville, at breezeline.net. And the email or Facebook kind of is easiest way to get a hold of me.
Gotcha. Well, I really, really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Jackson, for having me.
So that is Ben Cooper. Just what an amazing guy. What an awesome opportunity to learn more about bees. You know, like I said in the beginning, I went to this bee farm like 2 years ago, and I had no idea just how awesome bees were. I didn't know that without them, I don't think anything would exist. You know, the pollination that they do basically keeps the world running. And I didn't know, you know, that they weren't native to the United States. I didn't know all this stuff. I had learned it through that tour that I did. And of course, I shared some of that with Ben. He was gracious enough to let me share the knowledge that I had and fill in the gaps. But, you know, between their social structure and how they crown their queens and all the health benefits of the honey and the honeycomb and all this stuff, I hope you found it fascinating. I certainly did. I mean, if nothing else, it is the lifeblood of our world. So thank you, bees. Thank you for what you do and all the other amazing facts about you. I think Ben was really awesome in breaking that down and sharing with us. So I urge you to check out more about him. Just like he was saying at the end here, he's got an email that you can reach out to him with questions. He's got that book. The links to that will be in the show notes. So urge you to check that out. If this is your first time listening or you haven't already, go follow along to the podcast on Apple or Spotify. Leave a written review on Apple. Helps a lot. Leave that 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Really, really appreciate that. Follow along on Instagram, on TikTok. Both of them is Not Enough Podcast, Not Enough with Jackson Huff. On Facebook, jacksonhuff.com. Over 215 episodes at this point, so hopefully you'll check out some of those as well. But hope you enjoyed this one. We'll see you next week. Take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time, where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think, or hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.